Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. A reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 7, Chapter 2. Hiranyakashipu, King of the Demons. Text 45. Na shrota nanu vaktayam mukyopyatra mahanasu yastrihendriyavanatma sachanya pranadehayo Nashuta nanu vaktayam mukyopyatra mahanasu yastrihendriyavanatma sachanya pranadehayo Nashuta nanu vaktayam Mukyopyatra mahanasu yastrihendriyavanatma sachanya pranadehayo nashutra nanu vaktayam mukyopyatra mahanasu Yastrihendriyavanatma Sachanya Pranadehayo. Mukyodhyatra Mahanasu. Ladies? Na, not. Shrota, the listener. Na, not. Anuvakta, the speaker. Ayam, this. Mukya, chief. Api, although. Atra, in this body. Mahan, the great. Asu, life air. Ya, he who, to, but, iha, in this body, indriyavan, possessing all the sense organs, atma, the soul. Sa, he. Cha, and. Anya, different. Pranadehayo, from the life air and the material body. Translation. In this body, the most important substance is the life air, but that also is neither the listener nor the speaker. Beyond even the life air, the soul also can do nothing. For the supersoul is actually the director, in cooperation with the individual soul. The supersoul, conducting the activities of the body, is different from the body and living force. Please repeat. In the body, the most important substance is the life air. But that also is neither the listener nor the speaker. Beyond even the life air, the soul also can do nothing, for the supersoul is actually the director, in cooperation with the individual soul. The supersoul, conducting the activities of the body, is different from the body and the living force. Purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. The Supreme Personality of Godhead distinctly says in Bhagavad Gita 15:15, Sarvasya chaham ridhi sanivisto matashmritir gayam apohanam cha. I am seated in everyone's heart, and from me come remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. Although the Atma, or soul, is present in every material body, dehino smim yata dehe, he is not actually the chief person acting through the senses, mind, and so on. The soul can merely act in cooperation with the supersoul because it is the supersoul who gives him directions to act or not to act. One cannot act without his sanction, for the supersoul is upadrastra and anumanta, the witness and sanctioner. One who studies carefully under the direction of a bona fide spiritual master can understand the real knowledge that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is actually the conductor of all the activities of the individual soul and the controller of their results as well. Although the individual soul possesses the indriyas, or senses, he is not actually the proprietor, for the proprietor is the supersoul. Consequently, the supersoul is called Rishikesh, and the individual soul is advised by the direction of the supersoul to surrender to him and thus be happy. Sarvadharmam prajaja mam ikam sharanam vraja. Thus he can become immortal and be transferred to the spiritual kingdom, where he will achieve the highest success of an eternal, blissful life of knowledge. In conclusion, the individual soul is different from the body, senses, living force, and the airs within the body. And above him is the supersoul, who gives the individual soul all facilities. The individual soul, who renders everything to the supersoul, lives very happily within his body. Translation again. In the body, the most important substance is the life air, but that also is neither the listener nor the speaker. Beyond even the life air, the soul can also do nothing, for the supersoul is actually the director in cooperation with the individual soul. The supersoul, conducting the activities of the body, is different from the body and living force. Om Janayata Mandashaganam Janashalakya Chakshuramitam Yena Tasmai Shri Guru Vena Maha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayarupagadamayam Dadati Swabhantikam Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasudhi Gaura Bhaktivrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, everybody. It's nice to be here in Los Angeles. Don't get to be here very often, but anyway, it's very nice to be here. Very nice temple, community, street. Quite amazing. It's I spend quite a lot of time in Mayapur, and I've never been to Alatra, so I can't comment there. But I don't think I've been to a Hare Krishna center community outside of Mayapur. That's comparable to LA, where you actually, you know, you kind of have pretty much, not the whole street, I know you don't have the whole street, but you've got the whole first chunk of it, And it's kind of like, you know, it's like a Hare Krishna place. Fantastic. Most places we just have one building and one street in one city, but here we have the whole street, or most of the street. It's great. Okay, so carrying on from what was spoken yesterday, and also I'm sure you've been speaking for the last number of days, weeks, the difference between the body and the soul, difference between the body and us. And here it's just expressing that, you know, it's kind of a subtle thing. Things start from the gross platform. Well, actually, things start from the spiritual platform and come down to the gross. This is not good enough, is it? I don't know how to bend it. It looks pretty rigid to me. Ah. I guess I won't get a job in the sound industry or the whatever else. So it's explaining here, it's getting to the more subtle things of the life airs, but then above the life air is the spirit soul, but then above the spirit soul is Paramatma or super soul as being the most important thing like that. And that's a hard thing for us to fully realize, very hard to understand that we're not the doer, that all we really have is desire, and everything ultimately is dependent on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Even in terms of the material world and these buildings, that, you know, people find it very hard to accept that they don't actually create these buildings, and without the five gross elements and the three subtle elements, nothing can actually be achieved. It's just a combination of those elements that creates everything in the material world. So, you know, these are concepts that the concepts for devotees are usually okay, but to fully realize is quite difficult. So what to speak of the non-devotees, it becomes a very difficult task. So we see in this particular pastime, the family and the wives of the king, they're incredibly distressed when the king passes away. And so much so, they don't even follow the standard kind of Vedic customs of when, if you pass away in the daylight hours, then the body should either be buried or cremated by sunset. And if you pass away in the night hours, then the body should be created or buried by sunrise. So because of their attachment to the king, they even break those particular conditions. And of course, I think Rumpad Maharaj was saying yesterday, that when someone suffers a great loss, and we can also speak for ourselves when we suffer a great loss, that's a really challenging occasion. At that point in time, it's very challenging to apply these philosophical truths in totality. We may still understand and accept, but, you know, the emotions that are involved at the time of a tragedy like that are very, very strong. So that's what's happening to these family members of the king. And Yamaraj says, just a few verses earlier, he kind of echoes Yudhisthira Maharaj's famous comment that what's the most amazing thing, when he's asked, what's the most amazing thing that you've ever experienced in the material world? And Yudhisthira Maharaj's comment is, and let me, actually I'll just read what Yamaraj says, because it's very, very similar. if I can find it. Well, Yudhisthira says, when he's asked that question, he says, the most amazing thing is that every single person in the material world has experienced the death of somebody. Every single one of us, in my own personal case, all of my grandparents have passed away. Both of my parents have passed away. So we've all experienced. And I actually, just speaking from, I suppose, realization, I was 12 years old when my mother passed away. And that remains the most traumatic experience in my life so far. I guess I'm going to have a few more later on, but so far that remains the most traumatic experience. Of course, I wasn't a devotee then, I knew nothing about Krishna consciousness, but still just the overwhelming emotion of losing someone that's so dear to you and so precious to you and so close to you, it's a very powerful kind of experience. So Yudhisthira Maharaj is saying, although we've all experienced that, every single one of us experienced that, like I could ask everybody to raise their hands, is there anybody in the room that has all of their grandparents still alive? Nobody raises their hand. So we all have that experience. But, oh, someone did they? Can you leave? That didn't suit my question. Okay. Great-grandparents? Anyways, we all have that experience. But we all live our lives and behave in such a way as though it's never going to happen to us. And even as devotees, because, you know, Maharaj Yudhisthira is saying this, he's a great exalted personality. As devotees, I think we also have to imbibe these things and not just assume that somehow or another we've reached a platform that's actually beyond that. You know, that to be careful with jumping ahead of ourselves in that sense. So we all live our lives as though it's not going to happen to us. So again, for us as individuals, you know, how many times during a day are we not thinking, like Prabhupada said, that real philosophy means always to keep death right in front of you, to always keep death right in front of you. So, you know, how many of us are thinking about leaving the body, 24 hours a day? How many of them are talking about this happening or that happening, or, you know, some devotee said something about somebody else and this and that? You know, how many times are we distracted during the average day from focusing on this most essential point, as both Yudhisthira has pointed out? And here Yamaraj says, "Alas, how amazing it is. These persons who are older than me have full experience that hundreds and thousands of living entities have taken birth and died. Thus they should understand that they are also apt to die, yet still they are bewildered. The conditioned soul comes from an unknown place and returns after death to that same unknown place. There is no exception to this rule, which is conducted by material nature. Knowing this, why do they uselessly lament?" And of course, that's another a real kind of fear of leaving the body, is where are we going? Where are we actually going, both individually but also collectively? People, we can identify where you're actually going, and that's a great fear for people. People don't like to think about it, and of course, many people become atheistic as a result of wanting to deny that reality, that there is nothing after death, because, you know, it's kind of a scary thing. We've been living since time immemorial, but even if we just take this particular existence in this particular material body, most of us, as the Bible tells us, will live for 70, which is 70 years. So I'm 50 at the moment, so according to the Bible, I've got, you know, give or take 20 years left. So that's roughly, what, three-fifths of my time in this particular body has passed. So that 50 years, this is your day-to-day real experience, or my day-to-day real experience is living in this particular body. Now, at some point I have to leave that body. So that's going to be, and that's the whole process of Krishna consciousness. It's going to be a real wrench to do that. And particularly if we're not developing detachment from the senses, because our whole experience in the body, if we're not developing detachment, then our actual experience is what we experience through the senses, through the five gross senses, also the subtle senses, but mainly the five gross senses is how we experience life, how we experience everything as an individual if we're attached to these senses. And what does death mean? Death means we're wrenched away from those senses. That's what it means. We're just yanked out like that, and we no longer have that thing that we've been used to and experiencing for the whole time that we've been existing in this particular body. So yeah, so it's you know, preparation for death is like it's just such a kind of core aspect of devotional life, preparing like that. And we can see in this pastime of Hiranyakashipu being king of the demons, it was kind of like the moment when he really got full gusto into his mission of wanting to kill Lord Vishnu, and also wanting to destroy, you know, the whole kind of Vedic culture and the whole Varnashram system, kill all the Brahmins, kill all the cows, destroy everything. The kind of spark for that was when when Hiranyaksha, his brother, was actually killed, and that was what kind of sparked it. And then he accuses Krishna of being partial. Of course, Krishna tells us in Bhagavad Gita, Samoham Sarvabhuteshu, that he is equal to everybody. And of course, all these things are always, all these subtleties attached to them. He's equal to everybody. But somebody who renders service to him is a friend, and is in him like that and is special. And that's just such a natural thing. But everybody has the opportunity to render service to Krishna. It's not that it's partial in the sense that some have that opportunity and some don't have that opportunity. We all have the opportunity to render service. But those that do render the service, then yes, naturally, Krishna as a person is naturally inclined towards them like that. But Hiranyakashipu decides that Krishna's partial. And of course, Hiranyakashipu, you know, he's also giving a whole, he's explaining all these points to his family members when Hiranyaksha dies, and he knows the philosophy so well. And Prabhupada gives the example, it's like having co-wives. And if you have co-wives, I'm sure none of you have co-wives, but if you did happen to have co-wives, that Prabhupada's given the example that sometimes you'll get a situation where one is a very supportive co-wife, and one is not a supportive co-wife. She's a defiant kind of co-wife. And Prabhupada compares that to the demigods and the demons, that they're essentially the same, and they're understanding that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but that that the demigods are supportive of that, and that they're wanting to serve Krishna, whereas the demons are defiant of it, and they're wanting to challenge Krishna. So that's the essential difference between the two. But again, because Krishna is so merciful, and is Samoham Sarvabhuteshu, that even the demons, in their defiance, ultimately they achieve salvation. That's Krishna's special mercy on them, that they achieve salvation. So that was the catalyst for Hiranyakashipu's mission, the killing of his brother. And I often think that if we spin ahead, many, many, many chapters ahead, when Lord Nrsimhadev appears like that, the very last thing that Hiranyakashipu says before Lord Nrsimhadev appears, the very last words that he utters, and you know that picture that we have, of course we have that picture there of Lord Nrsimhadev ripping out the entrails, but the picture before that, actually, by the way, Sahasrara, are they're all original pictures, are they? Yeah, they're all original. Fantastic. Great. That's why we're not to touch them. But there we have the next picture of Hiranyakashipu ripping out, Lord Nrsimhadev ripping out Hiranyakashipu's entrails. We have that picture, my wife is over here, we have that picture at home, and we've had it at home for many, many years, you know. And our children, our two boys, they went to Gurukul up to the age of 11, but then we had to send them to... Actually, it wasn't even a regular school as such. It was called John Scotus. They have a connection to Vedic culture through Sankaracharya. Anyway, it's a long story. I won't get into all of that. But they went to that school, and they developed friends at that school, and they would bring their friends home. And they're both boys, so they'd be bringing their boys' boyfriends home. And we used to have that in the hall of our home, that picture. And nearly every one of them, to a fault, the friends, when they came in, they looked at that picture and they went, "Wow, that's really cool. Can I get one of those?" They really loved that picture. It was amazing, the boys. They really loved it. You know, it was amazing. So we did a good business selling them all the posters. But anyway, the picture before that, if you go before that, you see that picture of Hiranyakashipu, and he's got his shield, and he's like that, stretched out like that with shield pointing towards Lord Nrsimhadev. And Lord Nrsimhadev is absolutely massive. I remember that story about installing Lord Nrsimhadev in Mayapur when they were trying to get the deity carved, that the carver, first off, he wouldn't carve the deity at all, because it's just like they're kind of paranoid of carving Lord Nrsimhadev in case they make a mistake and they commit an offense, and the reaction will be so strong. But eventually the devotees convinced this carver to carve Lord Nrsimhadev. Then they told him, "We also want Prahlad Maharaj." And they told them what the dimensions were for Lord Nrsimhadev, and then they told them what the dimensions were for Prahlad Maharaj. And the carver says, no, I can't do that. That'll be breaking Shastric codes and Shastric rules, because Lord Nrsimhadev, I think, should be at least 20 times bigger than Prahlad Maharaj. And of course, if we had done that, we'd either have a very small Lord Nrsimhadev, or we'd have an incredibly large temple for Lord Nrsimhadev in Mayapur, bigger than the current TOVP that they're building, probably. So anyway, eventually they convinced the carver to actually do that as well, you know. So the carver compromised on two occasions. But Lord Nrsimhadev is apparently 20 times bigger than Prahlad Maharaj, and Hiranyakashipu is Prahlad's father. So at most, at that time, Prahlad was five, whatever, Hiranyakashipu was probably 3 times bigger than Prahlad. So therefore, Lord Nrsimhadev would be about 7 times bigger than Hiranyakashipu. So just even that as a dynamic, you know, that he's 7 times bigger. But there's Lord Hiranyakashipu ready to fight. The very last words that he says to Lord Nrisimhadeva, or that he says to himself, he actually murmurs them to himself, actually. He says, Prayena meyu harinoru mayina. And that roughly translates, I can give the correct translation, but that roughly translates into kind of colloquial English as, bring it on, Vishnu, bring it on, I'm ready for you, come on, give me your best shot. You know, that's basically what he's saying. So, like, how delusional is that? You know, he's got this tiny little shield, you know, this Mickey Mouse shield. And, of course, as we know, that's the next picture. So he was just totally in delusion of the whole situation. So the thing is that what protects us, what actually protects us from becoming Hiranyakashipus, what actually protects us from being the right co-wife rather than the wrong co-wife in relationship to our relation to Lord Krishna? So, because we have that minute independence, this minute independence is given to us all, and this is why we're all both in the material world, why we came to the material world, because we're misusing that independence, and also now why we're all sitting here in the Los Angeles temple participating in the morning program, because we're actually now using our minute independence in the correct way. But what actually makes the difference between the two? And in essence, the difference between the two is faith. That we have to have a little bit of faith, and then once we have that little bit of faith, try to develop it more and more and more, so as that the challenges and the doubts that come, inevitably come in our devotional life, that we have a strong faith so as that we can overcome those. And there are so many examples. One in the history of ISKCON, which I always thought was very interesting. My namesake, actually, the Prabhupada disciple, Pragosh Prabhu, he was a wonderful book distributor, along with, I've forgotten his name, there you go. No. Tripurari. Yeah. And because they were so good at book distribution, it was natural that they were going to train others. And they had an idea that how to actually train others to be good book distributors. And one of their ideas was to give them certain lines that they could use on the street. You know, how to stop people, you know, and then when you do stop a person, what you say to them first, you know, and then how you close the deal or close the sale like that. So they went to Prabhupada, and they had this idea. They went to Prabhupada, and they presented it to him that they want to do this to increase book distribution all around the world. And of course, as we know, Srila Prabhupada, there was very few things, if anything, that was more dear to him than the distribution of his books. So when they went and expressed to Prabhupada that they wanted to do this, Prabhupada's answer surprised them. He says, No, you shouldn't do that. You know, definitely that shouldn't be done. He said that the super soul is dwelling within the heart of every living entity. And as a result of that, every living entity is a genius, or certainly has the potential to be a genius because of the presence of the super soul. And therefore, if they just do their service, whatever that service may be, in this case we're talking about book distribution, then it will be successful. The super soul will inspire them to be successful like that. So it was just interesting. Again, that principle of having that faith. In an earlier purport here, I was reading, where Prabhupada says, and these categoric statements we read there, where Yamaraj is saying about death, there is no exception to this rule. And another word that Srila Prabhupada uses many times in his purports is the stringent laws of material nature. And of course, I'm in Los Angeles, so probably the first language is Spanish, but I'm sure that some of you have a first language as English. So those whose first language is English, the word stringent is a very unforgiving word. It's like there's no flexibility in it. It's a rigid thing, the stringent laws of material nature. And here, Yamaraj is saying, there is no exception to this rule. There's just not one single exception to the billions of living entities that come to the material world. So another statement I read earlier was Prabhupada saying, there is no happiness at all in the material world. He just says it like that in the course of a couple of sentences. There is no happiness at all in the material world. So us as aspiring devotees, we have to develop faith that that's completely 100% true. There is no happiness at all in the material world. Last night, after we finished our meetings, I had to meet with Rome Padmaraj about some other matter, and that went on till about 8 o'clock or something like that. And towards the end of that, because I've come from Ireland, actually, which is 8 hours ahead, and I only came, I don't know, 36 hours ago. So 8 o'clock in the evening is 4 o'clock in the morning in Ireland, UK. So normally you get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, but now it's 4 o'clock, and I haven't gone to bed, I haven't taken any sleep yet. And I said to Maharaj, God, I think I've got to go, Maharaj. And then, of course, on my way out, I bumped into a certain devotee. You may know him, Nisringananda Prabhu. And then 8 o'clock became 9 o'clock and 9:30. And I'm so... So at that point, these statements of Prabhupada, there is no happiness at all in the material world. I'm thinking, lying down on that lovely bed in the guest house, the life member guest house room that Swavas very kindly provided for us, I'm thinking, that's happiness. That is happiness. How can Prabhupada say there is no happiness in the material world? But there is no happiness in the material world. Another nice statement is, the austere, Prabhupada quotes, actually Krishna refers to this too, the austerity of satisfaction. The austerity of satisfaction. And you think, why would satisfaction be austere? Who doesn't want to be satisfied? Why is it an austerity? And then Prabhupada explains, really good reason, really good Prabhupada's purpose, because it's hard to understand these things until Prabhupada explains them. And he says the reason that satisfaction is an austerity is you cannot get satisfaction in the material world. So trying striving for it or thinking that you can get it or whatever, it's a massive austerity. So the austerity of satisfaction. So all of these things, we have to be able to develop that faith and be strong in our faith so as that we're convinced. There's another conversation that Srila Prabhupada has with his GBCs. I'm not sure what year it was, 74, maybe 75. He had a conversation with his GBCs. And the title of that conversation is, Are You Convinced? Are You Convinced? And the subheading is, That Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And this is to his GBC members, you know. So, you know, of course, they're 1974, they're probably neophyte. We're all really advanced now, so maybe it doesn't apply to us. But he's talking to his GBC members. Are you convinced that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead? There's two problems if you're not. One is that you're really going to struggle to make advancement and to go back to the spiritual world and go back to Krishna. And two, you're going to have a really hard time convincing other people. Because the main ability to convince somebody of something is that you're convinced yourself. And that really comes across practically without even speaking. Sometimes you can actually convince somebody of something through your own conviction. So are you convinced that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead? So in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 10, verse 7, Krishna says, Etam vibhutam yogam cha mama yoveti tatvataha so vikalpena yogena yujate natra samshaya. And, you know, when you read the Bhagavad Gita, you read it a few times, you always get hit with different things that maybe you didn't pick up on the first time. So I don't know how many times I'd read the Bhagavad Gita before this verse really, really hit me, actually. Etam vibhutam yogam cha. Krishna's saying that to Arjuna, if you are factually convinced, if you're factually convinced of my position, who I am, my opulence, my mystic power, if you're factually convinced of that, you will engage in unalloyed, another one of these words, by the way, unalloyed. It means there's no dilution or compromise or anything. It's just unalloyed. You will engage in unalloyed devotional service. Of this there is no doubt. So again, if we ask ourselves, how many of us, or we ask ourselves, are we engaged 24/7, 365 days a year in unalloyed devotional service? And if we conclude that we're not engaged in that, and I would conclude that for myself, then the corollary of that verse that Krishna is just speaking is that we're not actually convinced that he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We're not actually convinced of it. In the material world, primarily now, because we have such a kind of... modern is the wrong word. We have such a fast-moving and superficial kind of culture in the whole of the material world. you know, celebrity, and you're of course all here in LA, where, you know, Beverly Hills is just down the road, so it's kind of the home of celebrity. Celebrity is valued so much, and people really get glorified, you know, whether they're sports stars or whether they're film stars or whatever it may be, they really, really get glorified. And people will, you know, young teenage boys, because I had teenage boys, not teenagers anymore, football stars become worshipable. You know, they will have pictures of them on their bedroom wall, you know, worshipping these football stars. Actually, my wife is looking very distressed because our boys didn't actually do that, and I'm just using it as an example. But teenage boys do that. So if somebody can bend a football, you know, just bend it like that, then, you know, they become worshipable, and they're worshipped on the wall just because they can do that. Whereas Krishna, with just a glance, creates all of these universes just with his glance like that. And as devotees, we read that and we accept it like that. So why is it that we're not engaged in unalloyed devotional service as a result of Krishna's glories and his incredible ability? So it's all based on faith and developing that faith. There's one nice story related to a temple in Dwarka, the temple of Dwarka, the deity of Dwarkadish. And there's one devotee, one sevak in that temple, and he's been serving there for a long, 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 long time. And he's a cleaner, basically. He cleans the temple every day. So a very important service that he's doing. And he sees the thousands, if not tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people that come through the temple every day. And what are they doing? They're all coming looking for benediction or asking for something from the deity. And this cleaner is thinking that, wow, what an austerity for Krishna, that he has just to stand there all day and just deal with all these people filing through and asking him for things. So he thinks to himself, and at the end the temple closes and he's cleaning the temple and nobody's there, and he talks to the deity and he says that he would like to, he would like to allow the deity to go on a holiday, to have a vacation. And he offers to take his place, take the place of the deity. And to his surprise, Krishna responds and speaks to him and says, okay, you can do that, but there's one rule. And the one rule is, when you're taking my role, is that you cannot say anything. You cannot intervene. You're simply there in the Archa Vigraha form, and you don't say anything, you don't move, you don't intervene like that. So he says, no problem, Krishna, fantastic. So Krishna goes on his vacation. I don't know where he went. Maybe he came to Malibu or somewhere like that. And this devotee takes the place of Krishna. So during the course of the day, the first notable person that he noticed came in was a very wealthy man. And he came in. And the wealthy man was kind of glorifying himself a little bit, how wealthy he was and how much money he had, you know. But that he wanted to sort of get into a mood of, he wanted to become more pious and even more devotional, engage in some service like this. And that he was asking Krishna for that benediction to allow him to do that. And he took out some money out of his wallet. Of course, his wallet was stuffed full of money, but that was only a fraction of his overall wealth, actually. But even then, he only took a little few notes out of the wallet, and he put it in the hundi box. And his wallet then was beside the hundi box, and he put that money in, and then he paid his obeisances to leave. And he got up and left, and he left his wallet beside the donation box, and he walked away. And then the next person to come in was a very, very poor man. And the poor man came, and he gave all he had. He had like a few paisa or a few rupees, and he gave everything that he had, and he put it in the donation box. And he said, he said to Krishna that all he wants is to be able to. Him and his family are aspiring devotees and they're trying to engage in devotional service, but he feels guilty as a father because he's not properly providing for them. Sometimes they go hungry, etc. So he just wants to also to provide for his family properly, and he then pays his obeisances. And when he gets up, he sees the wallet there, and he thinks, "Wow, that was quick." And he got an instant response to his request. So then you know, innocently, he takes the wallet and puts it in his pocket, and he walks away and they're out of the temple. Round about this time, the rich man has realized that he doesn't have his wallet with him. So he heads back to, he figures, because, you know, he's so intelligent and he's so all that, he figures, how could he have forgotten it? You know, obviously somebody pickpocketed him and stole it from him. So he goes back to the temple. And as he goes to the temple, he sees a sailor. The third person who's come is a sailor. And he's paying his obeisances. And he just figures out, I've just left, he's the next guy. And he comes back to the police, by the way, and he tells the police to please arrest that man. I'm almost certain that he's stolen my my money. So I don't know how much experience you have of India, but you know, oftentimes with the police it can be like that. You know, you just ask them to do something, like particularly if you're a wealthy person, and they just, no evidence, no nothing at all, and they just arrest you. And of course, once they arrest you, you can end up in prison for a very long time. So the police arrest the sailor. They arrest him and they put him in jail. The main part of the story. They've arrested him and they're just about to bring him to jail. All the while that this has been happening, when the rich man left his wallet behind, the devotee performing the service or filling in for Krishna, he's tempted to intervene. He's tempted, oh, you've left your wallet behind. But then he remembers what Krishna has told him. And he says, no, I can't do that. And then when the poor man comes in and gets up and thinks, wow, Krishna's left me all this money, and he puts the wallet in his pocket, again, the devotee in the form of the deity is thinking, oh, I should tell him it's not his. And he nearly intervenes, but then he remembers what Krishna's told him, and he doesn't intervene. But the third time, when the sailor is being arrested by the police, he thinks to himself, gosh, if Krishna was here, of course Krishna would do something. So then he does, he speaks, and of course everyone's totally shocked, the police and the rich man are totally shocked, the deity speaking to them, and says, no, he did not take, the sailor did not, he hasn't got that wallet, he did not take it, he's a completely innocent man, so they let him go. So then the temple closes that evening, and Krishna comes back from his vacation, and he asks his devotee, how did your service go, what was it like, and he says, oh, you know, it was wonderful, but it was also challenging. I was certainly tempted on many occasions to say something and to intervene, but because you told me not to, I didn't. However, on one occasion I did, but I'm sure you'll be pleased with me, my dear Lord, because I'm sure you would have done the same. And of course, Krishna isn't pleased with him. And he points out to him that doing what you did indicates a lack of faith. And then that famous verse from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Nayasha Kahichid Rajan, that nobody knows the plan of the Lord. Great sages have meditated or studied for millennium after millennium to try and figure out what the plan of the Lord is, but they are none the wiser what the plan of the Lord is. So Krishna is indicating to this devotee that you had a lack of faith, that I know what's happening, I know what's going on, and all these arrangements are arrangements that I'm making for everybody's benefit. So for the rich man, you know, to help him in his spiritual life, I was taking something away from him because, you know, he needs to develop some kind of detachment. For the poor man who gave everything into the donation box, I was offering him some support to help his family. And as far as the sailor is concerned, he's a very pious devotee. But that night he was due to set sail. But due to bad weather, that ship has now sunk. And I was arranging for him to be arrested so that he'd be protected from that fate, because that is not how I wanted him to leave this world. But now you've intervened and you've pushed things in a different course. So this faith that Krishna's always there, and it's getting kind of late now. So, and sometimes somebody asked a question, I think it was, is it Bhrigu Padi Prabhu? You asked a question yesterday of Rampad Maharaj, and I was thinking about it. You asked the question about people who don't accept our the Shastra and don't accept Krishna's words or the devotee's words. How can we give them practical examples of, you know, that we're not the body? And that was the gist of your question. I was just kind of thinking about that. So when I was thinking about speaking on faith and having faith that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the Super Soul is directing the wanderings of all living entities of us, there's just one story that came to mind from a long time ago, actually. It was about 1983, I think, or 84, maybe. It's a completely 100% true story. There's no embellishment on this story. Sometimes people think there is, but there isn't. No embellishment whatsoever. I was doing Sankirtan. I was traveling with a devotee called Varuna, who you may know, actually, because I think he spent time in L.A. and Alachua. You probably know him, Lakshmimoni. He's Shesha's brother-in-law. You know him. Okay, so you know him. You know Varuna. Okay. So you can actually ask him to verify this story. We were traveling together. He was my party leader. And God, he was a tough party leader, you know, he was always getting on my case. Anyway, we were traveling together. And in those days, the program, it was just the two of us, the program tended to be that we got up at 2 o'clock in the morning. We chanted all our rounds by 4 o'clock, by Mangalarti time. We would then have a little morning program, or the first part of the morning program. Then we would usually take rest again for an hour or maybe an hour and a half, that kind of thing. And then we would get up for the second half of the program. Somebody would, only two of us in this case, someone would prepare breakfast and the other person would give Bhagavatam class. That was the kind of program. And then we'd go out on book distribution or whatever it was for the day. So we were traveling away from the temple. We were in a place called, there's a couple of people in the room that will know this place. We were in a place called Ross Trevor in County Down. Adam is shaking his head. Ross Trevor in County Down. Very nice place, actually, on the coast. But we were in this B&B, and it was a tiny little B&B. You know those kind of B&Bs where if you're not on your bed and you're moving from either to the bathroom or anywhere in the room, you know, you have to sort of, you know, sidle past each other because there's so little room in the actual room itself. So we got there relatively late in the evening, 8 o'clock or something, and booked in and we were there. And we decided that, you know, we're not chanting our rounds tomorrow morning in this tiny little room. It's an absolute nightmare. It's just too claustrophobic and too cramped and whatever. So there was a forest park just a mile or two down the road, nice forest park on the kind of the Mourne Mountains, actually, isn't it? The Mourne Mountains that was where the forest park was. So we decided that, you know, we'd get up 2 o'clock, take shower quickly, and by 2:30 we'd be in the car driving to the forest park and we'd chant our rounds in the forest park. So that's exactly what we did. Unfortunately, though, on the way to the forest park as we were driving, it started to rain. And then the rain got heavier and heavier and heavier. And by the time we were actually in the forest park, it was absolutely pelting down, you know. So we decided, well, hey, you know, we're not getting out to chant arounds and that. So we decided we'd sit in the car, which was even more cramped than the room. But anyway, there you go. We decided we'd sit in the car and chant arounds, hoping the rain would stop. Varuna, being Indian-bodied, tends to feel the cold. So he left the engine on and put the heater on, you know, to keep himself warm. So this is like 2:45 in the morning. You're in a cramped car with the heater blasting, you know. So within 10 minutes or so, have a guess what happened. We were all, you know, you're saying, you know, completely out for the count, you know. Two of us. Pitch dark, middle of a forest park at like 2:45, 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, in 1984 in Northern Ireland. I don't know if you're aware in Northern Ireland in 1984, but there was a thing called the Troubles was happening, which is a euphemism for people killing each other, the Troubles, setting off bombs and bullets and all that kind of stuff. So there we are sitting. The next thing we remember, not sure what time it was, the next thing we remember, there was this blinding light. That's what woke us up, actually, this incredibly powerful light, you know. And it was so strong, it took us at least a minute, if not more, to get any kind of vision. And it wasn't even proper vision, it was just kind of peripheral vision. We could get some kind of shadows and peripheral vision. We also heard this noise, this whirring noise above us, like that. So we're sitting there, and we actually couldn't figure it out initially like that, you know. But then as our peripheral vision started to come back, I could see, you know, the silhouettes of tanks, you know, and the silhouettes of men crouched down on their hunkers or on their knees like that with, you know, rifles pointing at the car, you know, like, oh, not rifles, actually, you know, submachine gun type, you know, those type of stuff, you know, stuff like the stuff that the army have. And of course, you have both eyes, so you could see out both the peripheral vision out of both eyes, and it was like they're on both sides of our car and they're all around. And then I copped on what was happening. And I wasn't aware if Varuna would cop on. So I was just dead still looking, and I said, Varuna, stay still, don't move, don't move, don't move, don't move, don't even blink, just don't move, stay completely still, do not move, you know. And of course, even that I was afraid of saying to him in case he'd say, why, what's wrong? But he didn't, fortunately. And I said, just don't move, don't move. And about 5 minutes passed, and eventually I saw an army guy and a police guy, because actually it's the police's job, but the army accompany them all the time because of the tense situation and they don't know who it is. So these two guys gradually came up to my window, of course. I was the passenger side. They gradually came up to my side of the window really, really slowly. And then they indicated for the window to come down. And of course, it was 1984. We didn't have electric windows. There were manual windows. So I'm putting my hand. I'm trying to do everything. You know, as you would have seen in the movies or whatever. You know, when the situation like this, I'm putting my hand and looking at his eyes and getting his approval that my hand is in there. This hand's going down now below the window to open the window. Like, but I'm, and of course, the other thing is, both of us have these bead bags in our hand. On the other thing, it's kind of like, you know, as I, so anyway, roll down the window. Window comes right down, and. The policeman comes, he speaks first. There's an army guy behind him. But the policeman speaks first, and you'll probably understand this because Adam's here in your community, so if you understand him speaking, you'll understand this. And the policeman leans in the window or leans over a little bit, and he says, "What are you doing here?" That translates as, "What are you doing here?" And I said to him, I says, "Well, officer." well, officer. And have you ever heard of the Hare Krishnas? No. So, great start, you know. So I have to explain to him, you know, what the Hare Krishnas are. And I says, "Well, we're kind of like monks, you know, and we like to get up early in the morning, you know, and we get up and we meditate. We do something called..." And I'm going to move my other hand now. This hand is in a bag, but in this bag, all that's in this bag are some meditation beads. That's all that's in them, nothing else, you know. And I slowly took out my beads, you know, and I said, "So we were here meditating. We chant a mantra, the Hare Krishna mantra. So we were sitting here and we were meditating like that. That's what we're doing here, you know." And he's looking sort of quizzical, and he's still really tense situation. The helicopter, that noise above, by the way, was a helicopter, you know. And the helicopter's above. There's tanks all around. These guys all down still with their guns all pointing at the car, you know. And I'm trying to explain to them where Hare Krishna devotees shall hear. It's quite funny, although it was still really, really tense, you know. But he still didn't really absorb it or take it in, or, you know, so it's still a really tense situation. But the army guy, because generally the army people aren't from Northern Ireland, they're from England, you know, they're from like that. And he was actually from London. Now, of course, in London, the devotees had a much higher profile. We'd had a number one hit record with the Hare Krishna mantra in 1969. And, you know, we were just more, had a higher profile in England than we had in Northern Ireland. So the soldier leans over and he says, and I'm going to get my Cockney accent wrong now, forgive me for this, but he leans over and says something like, "How's it going, mate?" He says, "No, you weren't, mate, you were sleeping." And immediately, all the tension was just completely taken out of the air. He understood exactly what he accepted. We were Hare Krishnas, he'd heard of them, etc., etc. And he says, "No, you weren't, mate, you were sleeping." And and it was just like, oh, you know, we could breathe again and release. But when it, and actually, just before they all left, it took a while for them to kind of, you know, leave and all that. The guy who was in charge of the operation, he wasn't one of those two. He came up to us and he says, "Just to let you know, gentlemen, that's cost us about £20,000 to, you know, to do that operation, you know, to come." They obviously thought we were terrorists, basically, you know, hiding out in the forest kind of thing early in the morning. We were up to no good. That's what they thought. But when they left, the realization that we had, we actually said it to each other, myself, I don't know if I said it to Varuna or Varuna said it to me, but the realization we had was, isn't that amazing, you know? Super soul is in our heart. Here we are supposed to be chanting Hare Krishna, and what are we doing? We fall asleep. So the super soul is making this incredible arrangement, you know, to basically wake us up and say, "Hey, don't think I'm not watching you guys, you know, when you're supposed to be chanting around." So just in the context of your question yesterday, I was thinking, you know, you could say it's coincidence, but hey, that's a pretty amazing coincidence, you know, that that particular thing happened. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.